My name is Paul Munya. I'm 32 years of age. Today is the 3rd of October 2007, and we are seated at the Baltimore Marriott Hotel in downtown Baltimore City. I'm here to interview Dr. Woodrow Winchester, who is my former schoolmate at North Carolina A&T University.
My name is Woodrow Winchester. I'm 39 years old. Today's date's the 3rd of October, 2007. We're here in downtown Baltimore, HFES conference. And I'm here with a friend, first of all, and a colleague, Paul Munya.
Okay. Dr. Winchester is an assistant professor in the Department of Industry and Systems Engineering at Virginia Tech University. He is the founder and director of the Laboratory for User-Centric Innovations and Design. He is also the program director of the Center for Human-Computer Interaction Research Experience for undergraduate students at Virginia Tech. So just to start off, Dr. Winchester, when you graduated, you actually had the option to either work in academia or industry. Now you're an assistant professor right now. Why did you decide to go to academia instead?
Oh, great question, Paul. And it's funny, I get this question often because I did spend some time after completing my master's degree and working in industry and then deciding to go back to grad school to get my PhD. So a lot of people ask me that question in terms of, you know, making the decision in terms of academia or industry. I chose academia because it was really the motivation for going back to grad school. Had the opportunity to do some adjunct teaching. There are lots of teachers in my life and had a lot of exposure to teachers. And just the profession has always been of interest to me, you know, because of that sort of exposure. And then being an adjunct professor, had the opportunity to be in the classroom and really see when students, you know, begin to learn and see that light bulb coming on. And that was really attractive to me. And it really motivated me, and it gave my life seemingly, you know, purpose in that I was able to help someone else kind of gain some understanding so that they could actually meet their goals and objectives. So really became kind of passionate about that, and that was the motivating factor for going into an academic career, and that remains the motivation today, and that's kind of where I place my emphasis is on teaching. But unfortunately, as you know, that's not necessarily where the reward comes from in a Research One institution where I'm at Virginia Tech. Lots of pressures in terms of, you know, scholarship and grantsmanship, and oftentimes teaching gets kind of pushed aside, but that's kind of the motivating factor for me and the reason why, you know, I chose this profession as a professor.
Interesting take, Dr. Winchester. Just as a follow-up to that to that question, is that what you wanted to do when you were growing up?
It's interesting because, like I said, it's like I've had exposure to teachers, so didn't really consider that as a professional option, you know, for me. It was something that I always, you know, kind of admired from the sideline, so to speak. But growing up, I wanted to be an architect, and that was the dream that I had. And as a kid, I remember, I couldn't wait to get home sometimes because my dad worked for, it's AT&T now, but when he worked for him, it was Western Electric. So he was actually in, like, finance with Western Electric. So he had access to a lot of the supplies that the engineers would use, you know, that sort of thing. So sometimes he would sneak in, like, graph paper from the office that he was working on to do, like, work at home sort of thing, and then he would give me some copies of it, and I just couldn't wait to get home to get that paper so I could draw houses. And I would spend hours, like, drawing houses, you know, that kind of thing, and really, you know, taking into consideration kind of the person that was going to live in that house and actually designing that house to fit that person. So, you know, that became kind of a thing for me. And then, unfortunately, when I started North Carolina A&T State University in architectural engineering, I took, like, the first couple drafting courses. And it was funny. I could not even though I could do it at home, you know, more on an informal basis, but in terms of on a formal basis, in terms of the drafting piece, I sucked. Majorly sucked. So in those days, we didn't have AutoCAD. Everything was kind of hand drafted, right. You know, that sort of thing. So there was an appreciation for that skill, and that was a needed skill that you had to do architecture. So unfortunately, changed from major, as we tell today, to industrial and systems engineering. But the whole premise around designing in concert with an individual has been kind of this overarching kind of principle that I've had and desire that I've had. So early on, it manifested itself in terms of architecture houses, and today it's manifesting itself in terms of like products and systems. So it's funny. I sometimes think about, you know, kind of how my career has evolved. And I think, you know, I've done all these sorts of different sort of things that have no connection, but that is the connection, the underlying connecting thread is this design for individuals, you know, taking into consideration that we are different, you know, people are different, and, you know, we should design accordingly. And according to the capabilities that we have and some of the limitations too, and specifically kind of leverage technology to compensate for some of those deficiencies or limitations that we have. But it's all about that premise of, you know, design for individuals. Yeah. So today I kind of consider myself, I guess, an architect.
So any sort of regrets for this career path then? Because it seems to be in line with what you set out.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I never really that's the first time I've ever really kind of articulated that too. So regret-wise, you know, it's funny. I guess I really don't have any regrets per se because I look at it as kind of lessons learned. Because, again, I have been fortunate to have these experiences that, you know, kind of fit in concert with what – you know, I believe in and kind of the core thing that I wanted to do, but they were kind of differing sorts of experiences and manifesting itself in kind of differing sorts of ways. So I guess really kind of no regrets, but lessons learned, I would say. Yeah.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit here, and I'm going to talk about something that is very close to me as an African-American scholar. Being a minority faculty in Virginia Tech, which is mostly majority white institution, how do you say your experiences have shaped your career so far?
Wow, that's a good question and something that that I often grapple with myself to some degree because, you know, coming from an HBCU, North Carolina A&T State University, I really enjoy that environment, and I think that was the sort of environment that I needed in order to grow and develop myself, and felt that that would be the environment that I would, you know, contribute into, you know, to help others like myself, you know, achieve their goals and objectives. As you stated, Virginia Tech is completely opposite, you know, majority white institution. And like, for instance, I'm teaching two sections of an Intro to Human Factors course. And I have like a total of maybe 130 students. And of those 130 students, I think I've got a total of 2 black students, you know, in both of those sections. So, you know, sometimes I feel that, you know, I'm not where the need is. You know, sometimes I think the need is with my people so that I can show, be that role model, so to speak, you know, that, you know, your goals and objectives can be met and you can achieve these greater things that you want to achieve. So that's why I feel that maybe I should be in an HBCU or historically black kind of college environment. But, you know, then sometimes I reflect, you know, maybe this is where I'm supposed to be at a majority white institution because, you know, we see in the media these perceptions, these stereotypes, you know, kind of exist out there. And, you know, and it's unfortunate, you know, that we see this in media and people form their reality based on those misrepresentations. And I represent something different that's, you know, that's portrayed out there. And maybe that's a good thing. And that's, you know, really being impactful, more impactful in that sort of environment than an environment where, you know, everyone looks like me. So it has been challenging. But through those challenges, there have been a lot of good things to come out of it. And perceptions that I had in terms of, you know, an institution like that and teaching in an institution like that have kind of been shattered because I've been embraced by the leadership at the university. I've been embraced by department at the departmental level. at my option area in terms of human factors, and the students have embraced me. And, you know, it's really been a great experience for me, because definitely shattered, shattering kind of perceptions from the perspective of a black male professor in that sort of environment. And also for me, in terms of dealing with white students, perceptions that I had kind of been shattered.
Interesting. Do you feel that you have more pressure maybe to succeed as a black faculty? Mm. As compared to the rest of the faculty?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that pressure comes from just visibility to some degree, because being the only black male professor in the department, you can't hide to some degree, you know? It's kind of crazy. And I think because of that, you know, because you're visible, you know, this visibility of the black skin and being a male kind of thing, you know, kind of lends itself to some pressure, because it's, you know, you're easily missed. So in meetings, if you're not there, you know, it's obvious that Woodrow's not there, you know, sort of thing. You know, if something is happening and, you know, I'm not participating, it's easy to say that, you know, Woodrow wasn't in the room, you know, that kind of thing. So it does offer some, you know, some pressures. And I think a lot of the pressures too are kind of self-imposed, you know, meaning that, you know, because I am the first and one of two, you know, that, you know, I'm under this microscope or magnifying glass that, you know, that I've got to perform. And, you know, then the fact that I've come from an HBCU too, you know, it's like, you know, I've got the weight of that on my shoulder. You know, I've got to prove that, you know, people that come from an HBCU can succeed in this sort of environment, you know, that kind of thing. So it wasn't, you know, kind of put on me by others. I think a lot of the pressure has been put on me by myself.
By yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I know Virginia Tech has been in the news recently for the tragedy that occurred on the 16th of April. We had 32 students shot. Could you just talk about that event in the light of what happened? Do you think that maybe the human factors as a profession, there's some things we can do to prevent such occurrences from happening in the future?
Oh, Paul, that's a really good question. If I could reflect personally first, in terms of how it impacted me, it was amazing that day, because I remember kind of the course of events. And actually, I've got the email kind of archive, you know, of kind of the messages that we got in terms of what was happening, that sort of thing. And it's interesting to kind of to look at that in concert with what was kind of portrayed in the media, you know, in terms of, you know, we didn't know and that kind of thing. And it's true, you know, in terms of dissemination of that information was kind of slow. It was slow. And in terms of the content that we got was kind of missing in detail. So there's an opportunity for kind of human factors intervention to some degree in terms of, you know, strategies for conveying that sort of mission critical sort of information. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so back to kind of this personal reflection. But immediately after it happened, you know, we kind of jumped into, when I say we, the faculty, staff, administrators, you know, immediately jumped into kind of reactive mode. So it became all about the students and making sure that, and that was the right thing to do, you know, that the students were okay, you know, that all of our students were accounted for, you know, whatever their needs were, you know, were taken care of. So it was all about, you know, kind of caretaking mode. So really didn't have the opportunity, you know, because of, and it was interesting too, because it was right near the end of the semester. So we already had a lot of pressures in terms of bringing things to closure in class for the end of the semester. And then, you know, this event sort of happened. So, you know, reactive mode, pressures for end of the semester, how are you going to close out your class? So really didn't have that opportunity to kind of reflect myself and take care of myself in terms of, you know, what happened in terms of, you know, that particular incident, because it was all about taking care of others. So it was funny, because this summer, I'm actually, as you stated in the introduction, kind of a program or project manager for research experience for undergrads that we have in the Center for Human and Computer Interaction. So that started immediately that summer. So I actually was kind of tasked at the end of the semester to start gearing up for that too. But I had this lull of about 2 weeks, meaning end of the semester and before this program officially started. And it was the bluest 2 weeks I've ever had in my life, actually. And, you know, it was really interesting, because I was like, what's happening? You know, what's happening, Woodrow? Productivity dropped. My eating patterns changed. You know, I was trying to work with the trainer, trying to bulk up, but I couldn't eat, so started losing weight. it's like, this is not a good thing. You know, what's really happening? And I really had to begin to kind of go inside and reflect. And it was, you know, because of that incident. You know, I was finally myself was finally having the opportunity to really process, you know, what had happened and the implications of that. So, you know, it took a while for me to kind of get to that mourning kind of stage. And that was those blue 2 weeks was actually mourning. And it took, you know, a little while within those 2 weeks to really understand, you know, what was happening with me. So it was really interesting from that regard, because I've never been as close to a situation like that, you know, before. And in terms of kind of the circumstances that were there that presented themselves in terms of being reactive, you know, taking care of students and not having the opportunity to take care of self until, you know, after the fact and kind of hitting that period of mourning. So it was really interesting, that whole kind of grieving and mourning process, which was kind of new for me. But in terms of, you know, the role that human factors can play, I think there is opportunity to some degree with human factors. And I think a lot of that has been addressed as we look at strategies to prevent these sorts of incidents happening, or, you know, in terms of, you know, strategy to kind of mitigate kind of the fallout from incidents such as this, because I don't think there's anything that we can do to from a total perspective, you know, eradicate these sorts of incidents. But there are things that we can do in terms of reaction, you know, about disseminating information, looking at different modes of disseminating information, understanding, you know, where people are, some of those contextual sorts of issues that we as human factors engineers kind of appreciate and have design processes and methods to kind of to understand and design systems accordingly. So I think now that's, unfortunately, it's become kind of a case study, you know, for, you know, crisis awareness, you know, crisis management, designing appropriate strategies, how we can leverage technologies. And I think human factors folk can definitely play a role in terms of doing that sort of work, you know, in response to these sorts of situations. So, yeah, truly there's opportunity there.
Thank you. So what do you think is the future for human factors? Yes, that's a follow-up to that question.
Wow, that's a big one, too. And it's funny, because I was talking to my students about this too, because we kind of wrapped up kind of the first half of the intro to human factors class, and we kind of talk about this a bit in terms of where the profession is going. You know, it's interesting. I think the profession is there's definitely room and opportunity for the profession. But where I see the profession going is more not really growing, I think, in terms of our knowledge set as human factors engineers, is now it's all about going out with this knowledge set into differing domains and different specialties, you know, that sort of thing, and influencing the way that people design products and systems, because the design process, as you know, Paul, you know, multidisciplinary in nature, right?
Yes.
And what we have to offer, we need to go out and influence all aspects, you know, of that design lifecycle, and all of those pieces are components that, you know, that impact design. So I think the role now is more on an outreach sort of thing, and letting the world know about, you know, human factors and the power, you know, of the tools and techniques that we've kind of, you know, evolved in this discipline, and begin to influence the way, you know, at a higher level, you know, that systems are designed, because we're in a time now where we're facing so many challenges, you know, as a nation and as a world. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much that can be learned from, you know, human factors that can be applied to tackling some of these very complex, to say the least, you know, problems. Yeah.
And just career-wise for yourself, what do you how do you envision your future?
Another hard question. it's supposed to be an easy answer to that one. I know.
Maybe just I could clarify it just a little bit. Do you foresee yourself staying in academia, moving up the ranks as a professor, or at some point you're going to switch and actually go to industry?
Wow. You know, it's funny, because I've had some conversations in this conference kind of about that. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know. I really don't know. I really love, you know, the classroom. I really love teaching. That truly is a passion of mine because I really love engaging the students. And it's and for me, it's all about helping them achieve, you know, their goals and objectives. So if that's a set of knowledge that they need to move their careers or, you know, to meet their goals and objectives, you know, if that's what they need, I want to be able to kind of facilitate that. So some aspect of teaching is always going to be there no matter, you know, what I do or what sort of formal role that I have. So definitely the teaching piece would be there. Is that going to be within the context of, you know, a professor sort of position, an academic position? You know, I really don't know. There's some really neat problems that are happening in the industry that have really kind of intrigued me. So there may be an opportunity to kind of, you know, go into industry for a bit and kind of work with some of those problems. And maybe, you know, while doing that, still, you know, being able to teach. But there are lots of challenges that exist, you know, in academia and in the academy where I think that I can really influence and kind of help facilitate change, needed change. So it may be opportunity for continued growth there. I guess right now at this age that I'm at, I keep telling my friends of mine that, you know, like going through midlife crisis, you know, because you begin to kind of contemplate because you're at the halfway point, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's like you reflect on kind of, okay, this front end of my life, kind of what I've done, and then, okay, I've got this much amount of time kind of left. And it's really weird where you know that, you know, at most you've got as much as you've expired left, you know, kind of thing. And it makes things, it brings things in perspective. It's really funny. So I think midlife crisis is real for men because you do see that, you know, there is an end to this because in youth you really don't see it. It's like you got all these years left. I can do so much. You know, it's like it's never ending. I've got unlimited resources here, but now I can see the end. You know, the end is really going to be here pretty soon. Sounds morbid. So it's like I'm reflecting in terms of, okay, where can the best use of these limited resources that I have to influence, you know, some positive change and make as much impact as I can. So I think that's now kind of the focus of my life and kind of how I look at things now. You know, it's more with that lens versus earlier it was like, you know, where can I go and make the most money, you know, kind of thing. Now it's where I can go and have the most impact. Yeah.
Okay. I'm a PhD candidate myself, so I suppose in the next few months or so, I'll be out there either trying to get a job in academia or industry itself. And I'm sure there are many other people in the same category.
Oh, yeah.
So what kind of life's lessons do you say you've learned that you can pass along to me and other aspiring?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Professors of the future.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny because I was in a workshop session yesterday and they kind of talked about this a bit in terms of like the what not to do's in terms of, you know, career. And one of them, well, one to do, and I can't remember how they framed it as a not to do, is to follow your, you know, your passion and, you know, where your passions kind of lie. And it's and how important it is to follow those in light of, you know, other goals and objectives that you're trying to achieve. You know, early in your career, it is all about, you know, because you're setting the stage for taking care of your family, you know, for instance, and you need to build a resource base. So you have to take into consideration, you know, these other folks that are kind of dependent on you for living. So it is about, you know, salary. But at the same time, you know, you want to be happy and have this fulfilled sort of life. And it's interesting how things work out. You know, in terms of following your passion, you know, people say that you follow your passion and then all the other stuff will work out. But what I found through, you know, just listening to other people's stories and kind of, you know, their life trails and journeys and et cetera, it's like when they've done that, you know, those other things have kind of, you know, fell into place. You know, and never, you know, have they had the, you know, want for a meal or, you know, family on the street, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, you have to do due diligence. It's not that it's going to fall into your lap. But if you actively kind of pursue where your passions lie and kind of work in concert with that, you know, things do eventually work out. So if that's leading you into the classroom, you know, definitely do that. Lots of opportunity there. Is that leading you into industry and working with some of these more kind of application-oriented problems, you know, sort of thing. That's where you should go. So it's understanding you and where your passions lie, and, you know, actively kind of pursuing that. Sometimes I feel that, you know, it's funny. Sometimes I feel I haven't done that, but it's weird in the context of this interview. I've kind of found that I have, and I always thought that I hadn't. But, you know, in actuality, you know, I kind of have. And it's funny how things have worked out, you know, and I have been, you know, blessed in terms of having, you know, jobs and opportunities that have consistently fell within that realm of kind of where my core, you know, passion is and kind of where I feel that my contribution is. So it does work. It does happen. So definitely follow your passions and do due diligence. Yeah. So, you know, just don't settle, you know, seek out and, you know, kind of search the entire kind of problem space, for lack of a better term, and opportunities, you know, are there, and just do the due diligence in terms of pursuing. Yeah.
Thank you for that advice. I should be sure to take it up in the next couple of months.
I'll follow up with you, Paul, to make sure that you are.
Okay. Just, you know, a lot of us regard professors as, you know, living in sort of ivory towers and so on, mm-hmm. because they're usually exclusive, they keep to themselves and all that. Just take us through a typical day in your work life. Wow. How does it go?
Yeah, for me, it's as un-ivory tower as it can be, I think. But I think that's the nature of the profession to some degree today, too, mm-hmm. in terms of professors being more accessible to their students. And I think it's a good thing, because... And it's funny, I think the HBCU model kind of was the leader with that. And that was the beauty of being at a HBCU, because the professors were actually, you know, kind of grassroots oriented, you know. And you know this, but you didn't do HBCU for your undergrad. But you've seen some of the undergrads at A&T and, you know, how accessible professors are to them and really a part of the students' lives and are there more, you know, than just, you know, this deliverer of content. Yes. But, you know, this facilitator or, you know, help shaper of
mentor.
Life. Yeah, mentor. Exactly. Yes. That's a good mm-hmm. term for it. Mm-hmm. So I think HBCUs have kind of been the leader in terms of that model that other universities today are kind of adopting and seeing the advantage to that in helping their students succeed. So for me, it's kind of the standard operating procedure is, you know, it's accessibility. So a given day, you know, it's usually, you know, interaction with students in one form or the other. You know, today, you know, we've got electronic forums kind of things, you know, to facilitate kind of interaction. So a lot of it's kind of email. We use a package called Blackboard. So we've got a discussion board, that sort of thing. So utilizing that kind of mechanism to interact with students and just face-to-face meetings oftentimes. And I try to stay or be as accessible as possible, you know, to my students. So it's all about, you know, kind of, you know, being accessible to the students. So lots of interaction through the day. A portion of my day, obviously, is in the classroom. So that's a bulk of the day, kind of preparing for lecture for the given day and delivering that lecture. And then kind of follow up after the lecture, too, in terms of, you know, making sure that, you know, address students' questions, you know, providing the additional clarity, that sort of thing. And then these sort of, it's interesting as you say that, these mentoring sort of interactions too. I think, you know, because I am black and we do have a number of, well, when I say number, it's all relative to some degree, several, you know, black students in our student body. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, you know, just serving as, they drop in, you know, serve as kind of informal kind of mentor, so to speak, in terms of, you know, problems outside of the classroom too. And providing any resource or guidance that I can in terms of assisting them. And not just, you know, other black students that look like me, but I think just kind of my personality to some degree, because I am accessible in nature and maybe too accessible sometimes. You know, oftentimes, you know, students, you know, feel that they, and I welcome it, you know, to address other questions that they may have in terms of meeting their goals and objectives, you know, even outside of the classroom. So, you know, a bulk of the day is taken, you know, with that. And then comes the research. So, you know, research is an important kind of activity that we do in the academy, especially at Virginia Tech, being Research One. So a lot of time spent in the lab. And then with that time, because most often it's the students doing the work, you know, interacting and mentoring with my students to kind of bring them up to speed in terms of, you know, the projects that we have in the lab and that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's a full day, and it's a day of interaction, it seems, with students and trying to maintain and be accessible, because I think that's, you know, that's our role, and that's what we should be. You know, that's why we're there. Yeah. That's why the state makes that investment in us. And I think that's why people are drawn to the profession. Yeah. So I think the days of the ivory tower and not being accessible, theorizing, you know, and all that kind of stuff are kind of over. Yeah. It's more of a collaborative effort, I think, today than it was in the past. Yeah.
Okay. I know that you are the program director for the Laboratory of User-Centric Innovations and Design, which you founded yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk to us a little bit more about that, what sorts of projects you're involved in, what kind of funding you have, cool. research grants, that sort of thing?
Cool. Yeah, so again, it's all about utilizing or understanding and applying differing sorts of design methodologies to spur innovation. So what are methods that we can develop to kind of spur more innovative sort of design? And this design that kind of accommodates, you know, these differing sorts of user bases and et cetera. So not only developing these sorts of methodologies, but then applying these sorts of methodologies in actual product and systems design. So we've kind of got a twofold sort of mission. So developing methodologies and then applying those methodologies that we develop and also other methodologies that are out there to kind of spur, you know, kind of innovation in systems and product design. So that's kind of the grand vision. And, you know, being junior faculty, this is kind of my third year. So we're still kind of establishing infrastructure to kind of get the wheels moving to make those sorts of things happen. But we've kind of been blessed in that we've had a couple projects in-house that have given us the opportunity to kind of begin to build that competency and kind of demonstrate that to some degree. We've had a couple projects from corporations. Specifically, we just completed a project with UPS. Can't really go into any specifics because it is proprietary in nature, but we had the opportunity to explore kind of an existing technological infrastructure that they had to do some more innovative sort of things for the organization. So that was really exciting to get involved with that and the opportunity to explore this technology and how it can actually be leveraged to do something that it really wasn't designed initially to do, but could really move the corporation to kind of the next level in terms of like training and performance. So really excited about that project. We've had a couple pilot projects that we've done in terms of looking at more novel sorts of design methodologies such as contextual design and actually looking at that and seeing how contextual design could actually be applied in the design of safety interventions for small builders. So contextual design, and we kind of talked about this earlier a little bit, you know, kind of understanding context of use. And oftentimes as designers, we forget, you know, that important aspect in the design of a system or product. So contextual design helps you to kind of understand those contextual sort of factors. So kind of using that methodology and looking at its efficacy in coming up with an intervention to kind of support some of the or mitigate some of the challenges, safety challenges that small builders have. So we actually completed that study. We've got some really nice preliminary findings, and actually right now writing a bigger grant to kind of fund a more full-scale study to actually explore this particular methodology. So really excited about that. The one thing that kind of the one project that really resonates with me is the, and then you kind of mentioned it, was the research experience for undergrads, and that's an NSF supported initiative, and really excited about that because we're able to bring in students from other universities that don't have the resources that we have at Virginia Tech and pair them with a faculty member and give them the opportunity at the undergraduate level to do a research project, to see it from, you know, from inception to actually, you know, completion, and to kind of whet the appetite for, you know, grad school and what the grad school experience can be all about. And we've taken a focus, my co-PI Scott McCrickert and I have kind of taken the focus to look at some of the students that are underrepresented, you know, in our field. And we've partnered with a couple HBCUs, including North Carolina Anti-State University, where we've been fortunate enough to bring in, you know, several students mm-hmm. and give them exposure to kind of some of the resource base that we have at Virginia Tech. and, you know, the exposure to what a graduate experience is all about, and have given them the opportunity to make a more informed decision in terms of, you know, if grad school is something for them or not. Don't have any data yet at this point because most of our kids were sophomores and juniors. So we don't have any students yet have made the decision to go to grad school. We're hoping to kind of see that maybe next year. But, you know, just some of the anecdotal evidence that we've gotten thus far and kind of the feedback that we've gotten from the students, you know, is really have changed kind of their perception of, you know, what a graduate school experience is all about, that this is something that maybe that they want to do. You know, these are the sorts of problems. These are the advantages that this can give you career-wise, you know, that sort of thing. And the experience at a historically white university, you know, because, again, you know, coming from HBCU, I have perceptions of what it was, you know, about, you know, at a majority white institution. And oftentimes the actual experience has really shattered those and put it under a kind of another lens. So had the opportunity to do that. So really excited about the work that we're doing with that. And hopefully we'll be able to continue that. We go up for renewal next year. So hopefully we'll be able to get continued funding from the National Science Foundation to continue that program, because it is just so needed. And the and what it's done, the implications of this sort of experience for students are just so great.
Thank you very much, Dr. Winchester, for that very interesting insight into your professional life and personal life as a human factors researcher, practitioner, and teacher. I'll give you the final word on this. Any words of wisdom you want to pass along?
Wow. No, thank you, Paul. This has been an interesting experience. Yeah, I didn't think through this experience I was going to be able to kind of really reflect at this level, but it's weird how this happens, yeah, because I'm a fan of StoryCorps. But, yeah, so any words of wisdom? Oh, that's a good one. Just be true to yourself. And I'm finding that more and more, the relevance of that, and kind of embracing who you are. And understanding, you know, your limitations and your capabilities, and, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of exploiting those and using those to the greatest, but at the same time, you know, being true to who you are, and for me, that's oftentimes a challenge, but as I get older, reflecting on this midlife crisis scenario, you know, it's becoming more and more kind of this guiding principle, and, you know, and understanding the relevancy of that. So just be true to yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you.